touch him.
Best not, her mother warned. Look at him. A filthy creature. The Queen turned her frown on John.
Lord Snow, what is this bestial creature doing on our side of the wall?
Wan-Wan is a guest of the Night's Watch, as you are. The Queen did not like that answer, nor did her knights. Sir Axel grimaced in disgust. Sir Brass gave him a nervous titter. Sir Narbet said,
I had been told all the giants were dead.
Almost all. Ygritte wept for them.
In the dark, the dead are dancing.
Patchface shuffled his feet in a grotesque dance step.
I know, oh, ho, ho.
At Eastwatch, someone had sewn him a motley cloak of beaver pelts, sheepskins, and rabbit fur. His hat sported antlers hung with bells and long brown flaps of squirrel fur that hung down over his ears. Every step he took set him to ringing. Wan-Wan gaped at him with fascination. But when the giant reached for him, the fool hopped back away, jingling.
Oh, no! Oh, no! Oh, no!
That brought Wan-Wan lurching to his feet. The Queen grabbed hold of Princess Shireen and pulled her back. Her knights reached for their swords, and Patchface reeled away in alarm, lost his footing, and plopped down on his arse in a snowdrift. Wan-Wan began to laugh. A giant's laughter could put to shame a dragon's roar. Patchface covered his ears. Princess Shireen pressed her face into her mother's furs, and the boldest of the Queen's knights moved forward, steel in hand. John raised an arm to block his path.
You do not want to anger him.
She's your steel, sir. Leathers, take Wan-Wan back to Hardin's.
Eat now, Wan-Wan?
Asked the giant. Eat now, John agreed. To Leathers he said, I'll send out a bushel of vegetables for him and meat for you. Start a fire. Leathers grinned.
I will, my lord, but Hardin's is bone cold. Perhaps my lord could send out some wine to warm us?
For you, not him. Wan-Wan had never tasted wine until he came to Castle Black, but once he had, he'd taken a gigantic liking to it. Too much of a liking. John had enough to contend with just now, without adding a drunken giant to the mix. He turned back to the Queen's knights. My lord father used to say, a man should never draw his sword unless he means to use it.
Using it was my intent.
The knight was clean-shaven and wind-burnt. Beneath a cloak of white fur, he wore a cloth of silver surcoat, emblazoned with a five-pointed blue star.
I had been given to understand that the Night's Watch defended the realm against such monsters. No one mentioned keeping them as pets.
Another bloody Southron fool.
You are?
Sir Patrick of King's Mountain, if it please my lord.
I do not know how you observe guest right on your mountain, sir. In the north we hold it sacred. Wan-Wan is a guest here. Sir Patrick smiled.
Tell me, Lord Commander, should the others turn up, do you plan to offer hospitality to them as well?
The knight turned to his queen.
Your Grace, that is the King's Tower there, if I'm not mistaken, if I may have the honour.
As you wish.
The queen took his arm and swept past the men of the Night's Watch with never a second glance. Those flames on her crown are the warmest thing about her.
Lord Tycho, John called. A moment, please.
The bravassi halted.
No, Lord, I only a simple servant of the Anabank Bravos.
Cutter Pike informs me that you came to Eastwatch with three ships, a galleys, a galley, and a cog.
Just so, my lord. The crossing can be perilous in this season. One ship alone may founder, where three together may aid one another. The Arnabank is always prudent in such matters.
Perhaps before you leave, we might have a quiet word.
I am at your service, Lord Commander.
and in Bravos we say there is a no time like the present. Will that suit?
As good as any. Shall we repair to my solar, or would you like to see the top of the wall? The banker glanced up to where the ice loomed vast and pale against the sky.
I fear it will be bitter cold up top.
That and window, you learn to walk well away from the edge. Men have been blown off, still. The wall is like nothing else on earth. You may never have another chance to see it.
No doubt I shall rue my caution upon my deathbed. But after a long day in the saddle, a warm room sounds preferable to me.
My solar, then. Satin, some mulled wine, if you would. John's rooms behind the armory were quiet enough, if not especially warm. His fire had gone out some time ago. Satin was not as diligent in feeding it as Dolorous Ed had been. Mormont's raven greeted them with a shriek of, "Corn!" John hung up his cloak. "You come seeking Stannis. Is that correct?"
"It is, my lord. Queen Selys has suggested that we might send word to Deepwood Mott by raven to inform his grace that I await his pleasure at the nightfall. The matter that I mean to put to him is too delicate to entrust to letters."
A debt? What else could it be? His own debt, or his brother's? The banker pressed his fingers together.
"It would not be proper for me to discuss Lord Stannis's indebtedness or lack of same. As to King Robert, it was indeed our pleasure to assist his grace in his need. For so long as Robert lived, all was well. Now, however, the Iron Throne has ceased all repayment."
Could the Lannisters truly be so foolish? You cannot mean to hold Stannis responsible for his brother's debts.
"The debts belong to the Iron Throne," Tycho declared, "and whosoever sits that chair must pay them. Since a young King Tommen and his counselors have become so obdurate, we mean to broach the subject with King Stannis. Should he prove himself more worthy of our trust, it would, of course, be a great pleasure to lend him whatever help he needs."
"Help!"
the raven screamed.
"Help! Help! Help!"
Much of this John had surmised the moment he learned that the Iron Bank had sent an envoy to the wall. When last we heard, His Grace was marching on Winterfell to confront Lord Bolton and his allies. You may seek him there if you wish, though that carries a risk. You could find yourself caught up in his war. Tycho bowed his head.
"We who serve the Iron Bank face death full as often as you who serve the Iron Throne."
"Is that whom I serve?" Jon Snow was no longer certain. "I can provide you with horses, provisions, guides, whatever is required to get you as far as Deepwood Mott. From there you will need to make your own way to Stannis, and you may well find his head upon a spike. There will be a price."
"Price!"
screamed Mormont's raven.
"Price! Price!"
"There is always a price, is there not?"
The Bravassi smiled. "What does this watch require?" "Your ships, for a start, with their crews."
"All three? How will I return to Bravos?"
"I only need them for a single voyage."
"A hazardous voyage, I assume. For a starter, you said?"
"We need a loan as well, gold enough to keep us fed till spring, to buy food and hire ships to bring it to us."
"Spring? Oh," Tycho sighed. "It is not possible, my lord."
What was it Stannis had said to him? "You haggle like a crone with a codfish, Lord Snow." Did Lord Eddard father you on a fishwife? Perhaps he had at that. It took the better part of an hour before the impossible became possible, and another hour before they could agree on terms. The flagon of mulled wine that Saturn delivered helped them settle the more nettlesome points. By the time Jon Snow signed the parchment the Bravassi drew up, both of them were half-drunk and quite unhappy. Jon thought that a good sign. The three Bravassi ships would bring the fleet at Eastwatch up to 11, including the Ibanez whaler that Cutter Pike had commanded on Jon's orders, a trading galley out of Pentos, similarly impressed, and three battered Lycene warships, remnants of Salador Sand's former fleet, driven back north by the autumn storms. All three of San's ships had been in dire need of refitting, but by now the work should be complete. 11 ships was no wise enough, but if he waited any longer, the free folk at Hardhome would be dead by the time the rescue fleet arrived. Sail now, or not at all. Whether Mother Mole and her people would be desperate enough to entrust their lives to Night's Watch, though. The day had darkened by the time he and Tycho Nestoris left the Solar. Snow had begun to fall. Our respite was a brief one, it would seem. Jon drew his cloak about himself more tightly. "Winter is nigh upon us. The day I left Bravas, there was ice on the canals." "Three of my men passed through Bravas not long ago," Jon told him. "An old maester, a singer, and a young steward. They were escorting a wildling girl and her child to Old Town. I do not suppose you chanced to encounter them."
"I fear not, my lord. Westerosi pass through Bravas every day, but most come and go from the Ragman's Harbour. The ships of the Iron Bank moor at the Purple Harbour. If you wish, I can make inquiries after them when I return home."
"No need. By now they should be safe in Old Town."
"Let us hope, Pato. The narrow sea is perilous this time of year, and of late there have been troubling reports of strange ships seen amongst the stepstones."
"Salador San?"
"The Lycene pirate. Some say he has returned to his old haunts. This is so. And Lord Redwine's war fleet creeps through the Broken Arm as well. On its way home, no doubt. But these men and their ships are well known to us. No, these other sails from further east, perhaps. One hears queer talk of dragons."
"Would that we had one here. A dragon might warm things up a bit."
"Oh, my lord, yes. You will forgive me if I do not laugh. We, Bravassi, are descended from those who fled Valyria and the wrath of its dragon lords. We do not jape of dragons."
"No, I suppose not.
My apologies, Lord Tycho." "None is required, Lord Commander. Now, I find that I am hungry. Lending such large sums of gold will give a man an appetite. Will you be so good as to point me to your feast hall?"
"I will take you there myself," Jon gestured. "This way." Once there, it would have been discourteous not to break bread with a banker, so Jon sent Saturn off to fetch some food. The novelty of newcomers had brought out almost all the men who were not on duty or asleep, so the cellar was crowded and warm. The Queen herself was absent, as was her daughter. By now, presumably, they were settling into the King's Tower. But Sir Brass and Sir Malagorn were on hand, entertaining such brothers as had gathered with the latest tidings from East Watch and beyond the sea. Three of the Queen's ladies sat together, attended by their serving maids and a dozen admiring men of the Night's Watch. Nearer the door, the Queen's hand was attacking a brace of capons, sucking the meat off the bones, and washing down each bite with ale. When he espied Jon Snow, Axel Florent tossed a bone aside, wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, and sauntered over. With his bowed legs, barrel chest, and prominent ears, he presented a comical appearance, but John knew better than to laugh at him. He was an uncle to Queen Selyse, and had been among the first to follow her in accepting Melisandre's red god. If he is not a kinslayer, he's the next best thing. Axel Florent's brother had been burned by Melisandre, Maester Aemon had informed him. Yet Sir Axel had done little and less to stop it. What sort of man can stand by idly and watch his own brother being burnt alive?
"Nestoris," said Sir Axel, "and the Lord Commander. Might I join you?"
He lowered himself to the bench before they could reply.
"Lord Snow, if I may ask, this wildling princess His Grace King Stannis wrote of, where might she be, my lord?"
"Long leagues from here," John thought. "If the gods are good by now, she has found Tormund Giantsbane. Val is the younger sister of Dala, who was Mance Raider's wife and mother to his son. King Stannis took Val and the child captive after Dala died in childbed. But she is no princess, not as you mean it." Sir Axel shrugged.
"Whatever she may be, at Eastwatch men claimed the wench was fair. I like to see with mine own eyes. Some of these wildling women, well, a man would need to turn them over to do his duty as a husband. If it please the Lord Commander, bring her out. Let us have a look."
"She is not a horse to be paraded for inspection, sir."
"I promise not to count her teeth." Florent grinned. "Oh, never fear. I'll treat her with all the courtesy she is due."
"He knows I do not have her. A village has no secrets, and no more did Castle Black." Val's absence was not spoken of openly, but some men knew, and in the common hall at night the brothers talked. What has he heard? John wondered. How much does he believe?
Forgive me, sir, but Val will not be joining us. I'll go to her. Where'd you keep the wench?
Away from you. Somewhere safe. Enough, sir. The knight's face grew flushed.
My lord, have you forgotten who I am?
His breath smelled of ale and onions.
Must I speak to the queen? Oh, a word from her grace, and I can have this wildling girl delivered naked to the hall for our inspection.
That would be a pretty trick, even for a queen. The queen would never presume upon our hospitality, John said, hoping that was true. Now I fear I must take my leave before I forget the duties of a host. Lord Tycho, pray excuse me.
Yes, of course,
the banker said.
A pleasure.
Outside, the snow was coming down more heavily. Across the yard, the king's tower had turned into a hulking shadow, the lights in its windows obscured by falling snow. Back in his solar, John found the old bear's raven perched on the back of the oak and leather chair behind the trestle table. The bird began to scream for food the moment he entered. John took a fistful of dried kernels from the sack by the door and scattered them on the floor, then claimed the chair. Tycho Nestoris had left behind a copy of their agreement. John read it over thrice. Now that was simple, he reflected, simpler than I dared hope, simpler than it should have been. It gave him an uneasy feeling. Bravassi coin would allow the Night's Watch to buy food from the south when their own stores ran short, food enough to see them through the winter, however long it might prove to be. A long, hard winter will leave the watch so deep in debt that we will never climb out, John reminded himself. But when the choice is debt or death, best borrow. He did not have to like it, though, and come spring, when the time came to repay all that gold, he would like it even less. Tycho Nestoris had impressed him as cultured and courteous, but the Iron Bank of Braavos had a fearsome reputation when collecting debts. Each of the 9 free cities had its bank, and some had more than one, fighting over every coin like dogs over a bone. But the Iron Bank was richer and more powerful than all the rest combined. When princes defaulted on their debts to lesser banks, ruined bankers sold their wives and children into slavery and opened their own veins. When princes failed to repay the Iron Bank, new princes sprang up from nowhere and took their thrones. As poor plump Tommen may be about to learn. No doubt the Lannisters had good reason for refusing to honour King Robert's debts, but it was folly all the same. If Stannis was not too stiff-necked to accept their terms, the Bravosi would give him all the gold and silver he required, coin enough to buy a dozen sellsword companies, to bribe 100 lords, to keep his men paid, fed, clothed, and armed. Unless Stannis is lying dead beneath the walls of Winterfell, he may just have won the Iron Throne. He wondered if Melisandre had seen that in her fires. John sat back, yawned, stretched. On the morrow he would draft orders for Cutter Pike. 11 ships to Hardhome, bring back as many as you can, women and children first. It was time they set sail. Should I go myself, though, or leave it to Cotter? The old bear had led arranging. Aye, and never returned. John closed his eyes, just for a moment, and woke, stiff as a board, with the old bear's raven muttering, "Snow! Snow!" and Molly shaking him. "My lord, you're wanted. Beg pardon, my lord, a girl's been found." "A girl?" John sat rubbing the sleep from his eyes with the back of his hands. "Val? Has Val returned?" "Not Val, my lord. This side of the wall it were." "Arya?" John straightened. It had to be her. "Girl!" screamed the raven. "Girl! Girl!" "Tye and Danel came on her 2 leagues south of Molestown. They were chasing down some wildlings who scampered off down the King's Road. Brought them back as well, but then they come on the girl. She's high-born, my lord, and she's been asking for you." "How many with her?" He moved to the basin, splashed water on his face. God, but he was tired. "None, my lord. She come alone. Her horse was dying under her. All skin and ribs it was, lame and lathered. They cut it loose and took the girl for questioning." A grey girl on a dying horse. Melisandre's fires had not lied, it would seem. But what had become of Mance Rayder and his spearwives? "Where is the girl now?"
"Maester Aemon's chambers, my lord."
The men of Castle Black still called it that, though by now the old maester should be warm and safe in Oldtown. "Girl was blue from the cold, shivering like all get-out, so Tye wanted Clydes to have a look at her." "Oh, that's good." John felt 15 years old again. Little sister. He rose and donned his cloak. The snow was still falling as he crossed the yard with Molly. A golden dawn was breaking in the east, but behind Lady Melisandre's window in the King's Tower, a reddish light still flickered. Does she never sleep? What game are you playing, priestess? Did you have some other task for Mance? He wanted to believe it would be Arya. He wanted to see her face again, to smile at her and muss her hair, to tell her she was safe. She won't be safe, though. Winterfell is burned and broken, and there are no more safe places. He could not keep her here with him, no matter how much he might want to. The wall was no place for a woman, much less a girl of noble birth. Nor was he about to turn her over to Stannis or Melisandre. The king would only want to marry her to one of his own men, Horpe or Massey or Godrey Giantslayer. And the guards alone knew what use the Red Woman might want to make of her. The best solution he could see would mean dispatching her to Eastwatch and asking Cotter Pike to put her on a ship to some place across the sea beyond the reach of all these quarrelsome kings. It would need to wait until the ships return from Hardhome, to be sure. She could return to Bravas with Tycho Nestoris. Perhaps the Iron Bank could help her find some noble family to foster her. Bravas was the nearest of the free cities, though, which made it both the best and the worst choice. Lareth, or the Point of Ibn, might be safer. Wherever he might send her, though, Arya would need silver to support her, a roof above her head, someone to protect her. She was only a child. Maester Aemon's old chambers were so warm that the sudden cloud of steam, when Molly pulled the door open, was enough to blind the both of them. Within, a fresh fire was burning in the hearth, the logs crackling and spitting. John stepped over a puddle of damp clothing.
"Snow! Snow! Snow!"
the ravens called down from above. The girl was curled up near the fire, wrapped in a black woolen cloak, three times her size, and fast asleep. She looked enough like Arya to give him pause, but only for a moment. A tall, skinny, coltish girl, all legs and elbows, her brown hair was woven in a thick braid and bound with strips of leather. She had a long face, a pointy chin, small ears. But she was too old, far too old. "This girl is almost of an age with me." "Has she eaten?" John asked Molly.
"Only bread and broth, my lord."
Clydes rose from a chair.
"It is best to go slow, Maester Aemon always said. Any more and she might not have been able to digest it."
Molly nodded.
"Dan'l had one of Ob's sausages and offered her a bite, but she wouldn't touch it."
John could not blame her for that. Hob's sausages were made of grease and salt and things that did not bear thinking about. "Perhaps we should just let her rest." That was when the girl sat up, clutching the cloak to her small, pale breast. She looked confused.
"Where?"
"Castle Black, my lady."
"The wall." Her eyes filled up with tears. I'm here."
Clydes moved closer.
"Poor child. How old are you?"
16, on my next name day. And no child, but a woman grown and flowered."
She yawned, covered her mouth with a cloak. One bare knee peeked through its folds.
"You do not wear a chain. Are you a maester?"
"No," said Clydes, "but I have served one."
She does look a bit like Arya, John thought. Starved and skinny, but her hair's the same colour, and her eyes. "I'm told that you have been asking after me. I am John Snow." The girl tossed her braid back.
"My house and yours are bound in blood and honour. Hear me, kinsman. My uncle Cregan is hard upon my trail. You must not let him take me back to Carhold."
John was staring. "I know this girl." There was something about her eyes, the way she held herself, the way she talked. For a moment, the memory eluded him. Then it came. Alice Carstock. That brought the ghost of a smile to her lips.
"I was not sure you would remember. I was 6 the last time you saw me."
"You came to Winterfell with your father. The father Rob beheaded." "I don't recall what for." She blushed.
"So I could meet your brother. Oh, there was some other pretext, but that was the real reason. I was almost of an age with Rob, and my father thought we might make a match. There was a feast. I danced with you and your brother both. He was very courteous and said that I danced beautifully. You were sullen. My father said that was to be expected in a bastard."
"I remember." It was only half a lie.
"You're still a little sullen," the girl said. "But I will forgive you that if you will save me from my uncle."
"Your uncle? Would that be Lord Arnulf?"
"He's no lord," Alice said scornfully. "My brother Harry is the rightful lord, and by law I am his heir. A daughter comes before an uncle. Uncle Arnulf is only Castellan. He's my great-uncle, actually, my father's uncle. Cregan is his son.
I suppose that makes him a cousin, but we always call him uncle. Now they mean to make me call him husband.
She made a fist.
Before the war, I was betrothed to Darren Hornwood. We were only waiting till I flowered to be wed. But the Kingslayer killed Darren in the Whispering Wood. My father wrote that he would find some southern lord to wed me, but he never did. Your brother Rob cut off his head for killing Lannisters. Her mouth twisted. I thought the whole reason they marched south was to kill some Lannisters.
It was not so simple as that. Lord Carstock slew two prisoners, my lady. Unarmed boys. Squires in a cell. The girl did not seem surprised.
My father never bellowed like the great John, but he was no less dangerous in his wrath. He is dead now, too, though. So is your brother. But you and I are here, still living. Is there blood feud between us, Lord Snow?
When a man takes the black, he puts his feuds behind him. The Night's Watch has no quarrel with Carhold, nor with you.
Good. I was afraid. I begged my father to leave one of my brothers as Castellan, but none of them wished to miss the glory and ransoms to be won in the south. Now Tor and Ed are dead. Harry was a prisoner at Maidenpool when last we heard, but that was almost a year ago. He may be dead as well. I did not know where else to turn but to the last son of Eddard Stark.
Why not the king? Carhold declared for Stannis.
My uncle declared for Stannis, in hopes it might provoke the Lannisters to take poor Harry's head. Should my brother die, Carhold should pass to me, but my uncles want my birthright for their own. Once Craigan gets a child by me, they won't need me any more. He's buried two wives already.
She rubbed away a tear angrily, the way Arya might have done it.
Will you help me?
Marriages and inheritance are matters for the king, my lady. I will write to Stannis on your behalf, but... Alice Carstock laughed, but it was the laughter of despair. Write, but do not look for a reply. Stannis will be dead before he gets your message.
My uncle will see to that.
What do you mean?
Arnulf is rushing to Winterfell, 'tis true, but only so he might put his dagger in your king's back. He cast his lot with Roose Bolton long ago, for gold, the promise of a pardon, and poor Harry's head. Lord Stannis is marching to a slaughter, so he cannot help me, and would not, even if he could.
Alice knelt before him, clutching the black cloak.
You are my only hope, Lord Snow. In your father's name I beg you, protect me.
Sansa. He wouldn't censor Loras, Sansa told Jane Poole that night as they shared a cold supper by lamplight. I think it was because of his leg. Lord Eddard had taken his supper in his bedchamber with Alan, Harwin, and Vaen Poole, the better to rest his broken leg. And Septa Mordain had complained of sore feet after standing in the gallery all day. Arya was supposed to join them, but she was late coming back from her dancing lesson. His leg? Jane said uncertainly. She was a pretty, dark-haired girl of Sansa's own age. Did Sir Loras hurt his leg? Not his leg, Sansa said, nibbling delicately at a chicken leg. Father's leg, silly. It hurts him ever so much, it makes him cross. Otherwise, I'm certain he would have sent Sir Loras. Her father's decision still bewildered her. When the Knight of Flowers had spoken up, she'd been sure she was about to see one of old Nan's stories come to life. Sir Gregor was the monster and Sir Loras the true hero who would slay him. He even looked a hero, so slim and beautiful, with golden roses around his slender waist and his rich brown hair tumbling down into his eyes. And then Father had refused him. It had upset her more than she could tell. She had said so much to Septa Mordain as they descended the stairs from the gallery, but the scepter had only told her it was not her place to question her Lord Father's decisions. That was when Lord Baelish had said, "Oh, I don't know, scepter. Some of her Lord Father's decisions could do with a bit of questioning. The young lady is as wise as she is lovely." He made a sweeping bow to Sansa, so deep she was not quite sure whether she was being complimented or mocked. Septa Mordaunt had been very upset to realise that Lord Baelish had overheard them. "The girl was just talking, my lord," she said. "Foolish chatter. She means nothing by the comment." Lord Baelish stroked his little pointed beard and said, "Nothing. Tell me, child, why would you have sent Sir Loras?" Sansa had no choice but to explain about heroes and monsters. The king's counsellor smiled. "Well, those are not the reasons I'd have given, but..." He had touched her cheek, his thumb lightly tracing the line of a cheekbone. "Life is not a song, sweetling. You may learn that one day, to your sorrow." Sansa did not feel like telling all that to Jane, however. It made her uneasy just to think back on it. "Sir Ilion's the king's justice, not Sir Loras," Jane said. "Lord Eddard should have sent him." Sansa shuddered. Every time she looked at Sir Ilion Payne, she shivered. He made her feel as though something dead was slithering over her naked skin. "Sir Ilion's almost like a second Munster. I'm glad Father didn't pick him. Lord Beric is as much a hero as Sir Loras. He's ever so brave and gallant." "I suppose," Sansa said doubtfully. "Beric Dondarrion was handsome enough, but he was awfully old, almost 22. The Knight of Flowers would have been much better. Of course, Jane had been in love with Lord Beric ever since she had first glimpsed him in the lists. Sansa thought she was being silly. Jane was only a steward's daughter, after all, and no matter how much she mooned after him, Lord Beric would never look at someone so far beneath him, even if she hadn't been half his age. It would have been unkind to say so, however, so Sansa took a sip of milk and changed the subject. "I had a dream that Joffrey would be the one to take the White Hart," she said. It had been more of a wish, actually, but it sounded better to call it a dream. Everyone knew that dreams were prophetic. White hearts were supposed to be very rare and magical, and in her heart she knew her gallant prince was worthier than his drunken father. "A dream, truly. Did Prince Joffrey just go up to it and touch it with his bare hand and do it no harm?" "No," Sansa said. "He shot it with a golden arrow and brought it back for me." In the songs, the knights never killed magical beasts. They just went up to them and touched them, and did them no harm. But she knew Joffrey liked hunting, especially the killing part. Only animals, though. Sansa was certain her prince had no part in murdering Jory and those other poor men. That had been his wicked uncle, the Kingslayer. She knew her father was still angry about that, but it wasn't fair to blame Joff. That would be like blaming her for something that Arya had done. "I saw your sister this afternoon," Jane blurted out, as if she'd been reading Sansa's thoughts. "She was walking through the stables on her hands. Why would she do a thing like that?" "I'm sure I don't know why Arya does anything." Sansa hated stables, smelly places, full of manure and flies. Even when she went riding, she liked the boy to saddle the horse and bring it to her in the yard. "Do you want to hear about the court or not?" "I do," Jane said. "There was a black brother," Sansa said, "begging men for the wall, only he was kind of old and smelly." She hadn't liked that at all. She had always imagined the Night's Watch to be men like Uncle Benjen. In the songs they were called the Black Knights of the Wall. But this man had been crook-backed and hideous, and he looked as though he might have lice. If this was what the Night's Watch was truly like, she felt sorry for her bastard half-brother John. "Father asked if there were any knights in the hall who would do honour to their houses by taking the black, but no one came forward. So he gave this Yoren his pick of the king's dungeons and sent him on his way. and later these two brothers came before him, free riders, from the Dornish marches, and pledged their swords to the service of the king. Father accepted their oaths. Jane yawned. Are there any lemon cakes? Sansa did not like being interrupted, but she had to admit lemon cakes sounded more interesting than most of what had gone on in the throne room. Let's see, she said. The kitchen yielded no lemon cakes, but they did find half of a cold strawberry pie, and that was almost as good. They ate it on the tower steps, giggling and gossiping and sharing secrets, and Sansa went to bed that night feeling almost as wicked as Arya. The next morning she woke before first light and crept sleepily to her window to watch Lord Beric form up his men. They rode out as dawn was breaking over the city, with three banners going before them. The crown stag of the king flew from the high staff, the direwolf of Stark, and Lord Beric's own forked lightning standard from shorter poles. It was all so exciting. A song come to life, the clatter of swords, the flicker of torchlight, banners dancing in the wind, horses snorting and winnowing, the golden glow of sunrise slanting through the bars of the portcullis as it jerked upward. The Winterfell men looked especially fine in their silvery mail and long grey cloaks. Alan carried the Stark banner. When she saw him rein in beside Lord Beric to exchange words, it made Sansa feel ever so proud. Alan was handsomer than Jory had been. He was going to be a knight one day. The Tower of the Hand seemed so empty after they left that Sansa was even pleased to see Arya when she went down to break her fast. "Where is everyone?" her sister wanted to know as she ripped the skin from a blood orange. "Did Father send them to hunt down Jaime Lannister?" Sansa sighed. They rode with Lord Beric to behead Sir Gregor Clegane. She turned to Septa Mordaine, who was eating porridge with a wooden spoon. "Septa, will Lord Beric spike Sir Gregor's head on his own gate, or bring it back here for the king?" She and Jane Poole had been arguing over that last night. The Septa was horror-struck. "A lady does not discuss such things over her porridge. Where are your courtesies, Sansa? I swear of late you've been near as bad as your sister." "What did Gregor do?" Arya asked. "He burnt down a whole fast and murdered a lot of people, women and children too." Arya screwed up her face in a scowl. "Jaime Lannister murdered Jory and Hewitt and Will, and the Hound murdered Micah. Somebody should have beheaded them." "It's not the same," Sansa said. "The Hound is Geoffrey's sworn shield. Your butcher's boy attacked the prince." "Liar," Arya said. A hand clenched the blood orange so hard the red juice squeezed between her fingers. "Go ahead, call me all the names you want," Sansa said airily. "You won't dare when I'm married to Geoffrey. You'll have to bow to me and call me your grace." She shrieked as Arya flung the orange across the table. It caught her in the middle of the forehead with a wet squish and plopped down into her lap. "You have juice on your face, your grace," Arya said. It was running down her nose and stinging her eyes. Sansa wiped it away with a napkin. When she saw what the fruit in her lap had done to her beautiful ivory silk dress, she shrieked again. "You're horrible!" she screamed at her sister. "They should have killed you instead of Lady." Septa Mordaine came lurching to her feet. "Your lord father will hear of this. Go to your chambers at once, at once." "Me too." Tears welled in Sansa's eyes. "That's not fair. The matter is not subject to discussion. Go." Sansa stalked away with her head up. She was to be a queen, and queens did not cry. At least, not where people could see. When she reached her bedchamber, she barred the door and took off her dress. The blood orange had left a blotchy red stain on the silk. "I hate her," she screamed. She balled up the dress and flung it into the cold hearth, on top of the ashes of last night's fire. When she saw that the stain had bled through onto her underskirt, she began to sob despite herself. She ripped off the rest of her clothes wildly, threw herself into bed, and cried herself back to sleep. It was midday when Septa Mordain knocked upon her door.
"Sansa, your lord father will see you now."
Sansa sat up.
"Lady,"
she whispered. For a moment it was as if the direwolf was there in the room, looking at her with those golden eyes, sad and knowing. She had been dreaming, she realized. Lady was with her, and they were running together, and trying to remember was like trying to catch the rain with her fingers. The dream faded, and Lady was dead again.
"Sansa?"
The rap came again, sharply.
"Do you hear me?"
"Yes, Septa," she called out.
"Might I have a moment to dress, please?"
Her eyes were red from crying, but she did her best to make herself beautiful. Lord Eddard was bent over a huge leather-bound book when Septa Mordain marched her into the solar, his plaster-wrapped leg stiff beneath the table. "Come here, Sansa," he said, not unkindly, when the Septa had gone for her sister. "Sit beside me." He closed the book. Septa Mordain returned with Arya squirming in her grasp. Sansa had put on a lovely pale green damask gown and a look of remorse. But her sister was still wearing the ratty leathers and rough spin she'd worn at breakfast.
"Here is the other one," the Septa announced.
"My thanks, Septa Mordain. I would talk to my daughters alone, if you would be so kind." The Septa bowed and left.
"Arya started it,"
Sansa said quickly, anxious to have the first word.
"She called me a liar and threw an orange at me and spoiled my dress. The ivory silk, the one Queen Cersei gave me when I was betrothed to Prince Joffrey. She hates that I'm going to marry the prince. She tries to spoil everything. Father, she can't stand for anything to be beautiful or nice or splendid."
"Enough, Sansa." Lord Eddard's voice was sharp with impatience. Arya raised her eyes.
"I'm sorry, Father. I was wrong, and I beg my sweet sister's forgiveness."
Sansa was so startled that for a moment she was speechless. Finally, she found her voice.
"What about my dress? Maybe I could wash it,"
Arya said doubtfully.
"Washing won't do any good," Sansa said. "Not if you scrubbed all day and all night. The silk is ruined." "Then I'll make you a new one,"
Arya said. Sansa threw back her head in disdain.
You couldn't sew a dress fit to clean the pigsties."
Their father sighed. "I did not call you here to talk of dresses. I'm sending you both back to Winterfell." For the second time, Sansa found herself too stunned for words. She felt her eyes grow moist again.
"You can't," Arya said. "Please, father,"
Sansa managed at last.
"Please don't."
Eddard Stark favoured his daughters with a tired smile. "At last we've found something you agree on." Eddard Stark favoured his daughters with a tired smile. "At last we've found something you agree on."
"I didn't do anything wrong," Sansa pleaded with him. "I don't want to go back."
She loved King's Landing, the pageantry of the court, the high lords and ladies in their velvets and silks and gemstones, the great city with all its people. The tournament had been the most magical time of her whole life, and there was so much she had not yet seen, harvest feasts and masked balls and mummer shows. She could not bear the thought of losing it all.
"Send Arya away. She started it, Father. I swear it. I'll be good, you'll see. Just let me stay, and I promise to be as fine and noble and courteous as the Queen."
Father's mouth twitched strangely. "Sansa, I'm not sending you away for fighting, though the guards know I'm sick of you two squabbling. I want you back in Winterfall for your own safety. Three of my men were cut down like dogs not a league from where we sit. And what does Robert do? He goes hunting." Arya was chewing at her lip in that disgusting way she had.
"Can we take Syria back with us?"
"Who cares about your stupid dancing master?" Sansa flared.
"Father, I only just now remembered I can't go away. I'm to marry Prince Geoffrey.
She tried to smile bravely for him.
I love him, Father. I truly, truly do. I love him as much as Queen Nereus loved Prince Aemon, the Dragon Knight, as much as Jonquil loves Sir Florian. I want to be his queen and have his babies.
Sweet one, her father said gently, listen to me. When you're old enough, I will make you a match with a high lord who's worthy of you, someone brave and gentle and strong. This match with Geoffrey was a terrible mistake. That boy is no Prince Aemon, you must believe me.
He is, Sansa insisted. I don't want someone brave and gentle, I want him. We'll be ever so happy, just like in the songs, you'll see. I'll give him a son with golden hair, and one day he'll be the king of all the realm, the greatest king that ever was, as brave as a wolf and as proud as a lion.
Arya made a face.
Not if Geoffrey's his father, she said. He's a liar and a craven, and anyhow, he's a stag, not a lion.
Sansa felt tears in her eyes.
He is not. He's not the least bit like that old drunken king.
She screamed at her sister, forgetting herself in her grief.
Father looked at her strangely.
Gods, he swore softly, out of the mouths of babes.
He shouted for Septa Mordain. To the girls he said, I'm looking for a fast-trading galley to take you home. These days the sea is safer than the King's Road. You will sail as soon as I can find a proper ship with Septa Mordain and a complement of guards, and yes, with Sirio Forel, if he agrees to enter my service. But say nothing of this. It's better if no one knows of our plans. We will talk again tomorrow. Sansa cried as Septa Mordain marched them down the steps. They were going to take it all away, the tournaments and the court and her prince, everything. They were going to send her back to the bleak grey walls of Winterfell and lock her up forever. Her life was over before it had begun.
Stop that weeping, child, Septa Mordain said sternly. I am certain your lord father knows what's best for you.
It won't be so bad, Sansa, Arya said. We're going to sail on a galley. It'll be an adventure. And then we'll be with Bran and Rob again and old Nan and Hodor and the rest.
She touched on the arm.
Hodor! Sansa yelled. You ought to marry Hodor. You're just like him, stupid and hairy and ugly.
She wrenched away from her sister's hand, stormed into her bedchamber, and barred the door behind her. Tyrion. The Queen intends to send Prince Tommen away. They knelt alone in the hushed dimness of the sept, surrounded by shadows and flickering candles. But even so, Lancel kept his voice low. Lord Giles will take him to Rosby and conceal him there in the guise of a page. They plan to darken his hair and tell everyone that he is the son of a hedge knight.
Is it the mob she fears, or me?
Both, said Lancel.
Ah, Tyrion had known nothing of this ploy. Had Varys's little birds failed him for once? Even spiders must nod, he supposed. Or was the eunuch playing a deeper and more subtle game than he knew? You have my thanks, sir. Will you grant me the boon I asked of you? Perhaps. Lancel wanted his own command in the next battle. A splendid way to die before he finished growing that moustache, but young knights always think themselves invincible. Tyrion lingered after his cousin had slipped away. At the warrior's altar, he used one candle to light another. Watch over my brother, you bloody bastard, is one of yours. He lit a second candle to the stranger, for himself. That night, when the Red Keep was dark, Bronn arrived to find him sealing a letter. Take this to Sir Jaslyn Bywater. The dwarf dribbled hot golden wax down onto the parchment.
What does it say?
Bronn could not read, so he asked impudent questions.
That he's to take 50 of his best swords and scout the Rose Road.
Tyrion pressed his seal into the soft wax.
Stannis is more like to come up the King's Road.
Oh, I know. Tell Bywater to disregard what's in the letter and take his men north.
He's to lay a trap along the Rusby Road. Lord Giles will depart for his castle in a day or two, with a dozen men-at-arms, some servants, and my nephew. Prince Tommen may be dressed as a page. You want the boy brought back, is that it? No, I want him taken onto the castle. Removing the boy from the city was one of his sister's better notions, Tyrion had decided. At Rosby, Tommen would be safe from the mob, and keeping him apart from his brother also made things more difficult for Stannis. Even if he took King's Landing and executed Joffrey, he'd still have a Lannister claimant to contend with. Lord Giles is too sickly to run and too craven to fight. He'll command his castellan to open the gates. Once inside the walls, Bywater is to expel the garrison and hold Tommen there safe. Ask him how he likes the sound of Lord Bywater. Lord Bronn would sound better. I could grab the boy for you just as well. I'll dandle him on my knee and sing him nursery songs, if there's a lordship in it. I need you here, said Tyrion, and I don't trust you with my nephew. Should any ill befall Joffrey, the Lannister claim to the Iron Throne would rest on Tommen's young shoulders. Sir Jaslyn's gold cloaks would defend the boy. Bronn's sellswords were more apt to sell him to his enemies. What should the new lord do with the old one? Whatever he pleases, so long as he remembers to feed him. I don't want him dying. Tyrion pushed away from the table. My sister will send one of the king's guard with the prince. Bronn was not concerned. The hound is Joffrey's dog. He won't leave him. Ironhand's gold cloaks should be able to handle the others easy enough. If it comes to killing, tell Sir Jaslyn I won't have it done in front of Tommen. Tyrion donned a heavy cloak of dark brown wool. My nephew is tender-hearted. He is certain he's a Lannister. I'm certain of nothing but winter and battle, he said. Come, I'm riding with you part of the way. Shatayas, you know me too well. They left through a postern gate in the north wall. Tyrion put his heels into his horse and clattered down Shadow Black Lane. A few furtive shapes darted into alleys at the sound of hoofbeats on the cobbles, but no one dared accost them. The council had extended his curfew. It was death to be taken on the streets after the evenfall bells had sung. The measure had restored a degree of peace to King's Landing and quartered the number of corpses found in the alleys of a morning. Yet Varys said the people cursed him for it. They should be thankful they have the breath to curse. A pair of gold cloaks confronted them as they were making their way along Coppersmith's Wynd, but when they realized whom they challenged, they begged the hands' pardons and waved them on. Bronn turned south for the Mudgate, and they parted company. Tyrion rode on towards Chitaya's, but suddenly his patience deserted him. He twisted in the saddle, scanning the street behind. There were no signs of followers. Every window was dark or tightly shuttered. He heard nothing but the wind swirling down the alleys. If Cersei had someone stalking me tonight, he must be disguised as a rat. Bugger it all, he muttered. He was sick of caution. Wheeling his horse around, he dug in his spurs. If anyone's after me, we'll see how well they ride. He flew through the moonlit streets, clattering over cobbles, darting down narrow alleys and up twisting wynds, racing to his love. As he hammered on the gate, he heard music wafting faintly over the spiked stone walls. One of the Ebonese ushered him inside. Tyrion gave the man his horse and said, "Who is that?" The diamond-shaped panes of the long-hall windows shone with yellow light, and he could hear a man singing. The Ebonese shrugged. "Fat belly singer." The sound swelled as he walked from the stable to the house. Tyrion had never been fond of singers, and he liked this one even less than the run of the breed, sight unseen. When he pushed open the door, the man broke off. "My lord Hand." He knelt, balding and kettle-bellied, murmuring, "An honor, an honor." "My lord." Shay smiled at the sight of him. He liked that smile, the quick, unthinking way it came to her pretty face. The girl wore her purple silk, belted with a cloth of silver sash. The colours favoured her dark hair,